It's been going on for 20 years. We've been at this for a year and a half or 2 years. I mean, it seems to me that as a culture, we need to learn patience, you know, and to not believe in silver bullet answers to mysterious problems like the mysteries of human pain, you know.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was reporter Sam Quiñones testifying in front of a Senate committee last month about why the opioid crisis hasn't been solved yet. Now, as many Pulse Check listeners will know, Sam is the author of Dreamland, one of the great health policy books, an investigation into the rise of the opioid crisis. We spoke last month about how the crisis got so bad, what Sam learned in his reporting, and where we go from here, among other questions that I had or were submitted by listeners. Now, two important notes. I loved my discussion with Sam, but unfortunately the audio on his end is just a little rough. We wanted to bring you this conversation anyway because it's so timely and fascinating. And since Sam and I spoke, there have been a few developments. For instance, the Trump administration this week proposed adding $13 billion more in funding to the opioid fight. So keep that in mind as you're listening through. Just a reminder, if you like Pulse Check, you can rate us, review us on your favorite podcast app. That helps us find new listeners. And you can let me know at ddiamond@politico.com about who you'd like to hear from next. We didn't have an episode of Pulse Check last week. I had a family health emergency that kept me away, but we're looking forward to getting back to our usual routine. And this past week was a good reminder. For all the talk about health policy and politics on this podcast, I have such gratitude and appreciation for our nation's healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, techs, and more who work so hard to keep our families healthy. And with that, here's Sam Quiñones. Let's start with this. You're the author of Dreamland, and a triumph of on-the-ground reporting and business and financial journalism. When I told folks around the newsroom that I was going to be talking to you, there were two reactions. Either, what a great book, I'm so glad I read it, or I'm so embarrassed I haven't read this book, I need to. Just basically, yeah, like there really is no better dynamic than that. But you were not a healthcare reporter, and you and I have talked about this a bit. You were a reporter who's focused on Mexico, who tracked the border. How did you discover this story?
Yes, I had no interest in writing about healthcare. I was actively not trying to write about healthcare, in fact. I just wanted to write about gangs and the border. I discovered this because at the Times, at the LA Times where I was working in 2008 and 9, they put me on a team of reporters to cover the very savage drug war kicking off in Mexico. And my job was to cover how drugs were trafficked once they crossed the border. And one day I was just tooling around. I was interested in why there would be any, why heroin traffickers in Mexico would be doing such banner business. Seizures were up all across the country. I was hearing these reports of this. And so I began to look into that. That led me to figure out the story of this small town in Mexico, Jalisco, Nayarit. But the real question in my mind was, I wanted to write the big heroin story. Like, why are all these people selling more? I thought heroin was an old drug, passe. Why would anybody do more people do it today, you know? And that led me to that story about Jalisco. But the reason then I figured out that they had a big market for their drugs was this massive change in healthcare and pain management in particular. Beginning back in the 1990s. When I was in Mexico, I knew nothing of that. Really, literally, when I came back from Mexico, I could tell you I did not know what a Vicodin was or what an OxyContin.
Or the Sackler family behind Purdue Pharma, which now you and others have really excavated their history. There's a through line in Dreamland that really stood out to me, which is this influence of capitalism, in a sense. In Mexico, there were so few opportunities professionally, and yet here comes heroin, and this is a financial transformer, maybe not to make people millionaire kingpins, but at least to elevate their lifestyle, and then that kind of inspired envy among others. And then on the flip side, you've got in America, in the United States, these well-to-do suburbanites living in what they think is the American dream and feeling in their cores empty and hollow and have pain. And then becoming financially depressed because they're spending their money on the drugs.
Oh, I think this is both parts of that are correct.
Well, it's your book, yes. So I'm just paraphrasing
exactly,
your theme.
No, exactly. Precisely. That's one of the first things I noticed, that heroin tended to change the lifestyle, the social balance back home, right? That If you got involved in selling heroin, all of a sudden your mom was treated with great respect when she went to the baker, before the baker would yell at her or speak sharply to her because she was going to ask him for credit and you didn't want to give it. Well, it changed the balance, social balance, back home. And I always viewed it really as almost like an immigrant story, really. More than a drug story, it's an immigrant story. The folks who were coming north on the same impulse that sent other people north to be landscapers in Dallas, for example. These guys just were going north to sell heroin, and they were the same kind of people. They were not drug cartel killers, you know, commando types, and they were bakers and butchers and avocado farmers and sugarcane farmers, and all jobs leading nowhere. You're never going to get a woman to talk to you, to marry you. You'd never be able to buy a house with that. Heroin allowed them all to kind of, you know, and all of a sudden you come back. You're a poor kid who no one has paid attention to all your life, just a cheap pair of jeans, and you come back with Levi's 501s and cash to buy all the beer for all your new friends in the plaza, and all the girls want to talk with. That is the narcotic those guys were addicted to. They were not using their own drugs. They were addicted to coming back a king. I found that fascinating, but also very common. When you go throughout immigrant Mexico, you see that return is very potent. People come back and, you know, show off what they've earned and build their another room on their house and this kind of thing. It's a way of showing, I left here poor, you ran me out. That's a certain feeling of people among immigrants, and I'm back to show you what I've actually could achieve when I had a chance.
And that's one of the things that I thought was so fascinating about Dreamland, because for all the reporting, and there's still more to do about what's happening in the United States, This is part of why we have the epidemic that we do. And you made this point, I want to pull it back out, which is these folks selling heroin, the black tar heroin, weren't users. They weren't kingpins as Hollywood might portray them. They didn't have weapons, in part because of fear that as undocumented immigrants, if they're discovered with weapons, if they're mixed up in crime, they're going to be that much more exactly kicked out. You're making symbols. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Lengthy prison sentences with a gun.
Yeah, yeah. So their initiative, their innovation was basically to be salesmen. With better marketing techniques and delivery techniques.
Exactly. They knew how to market, and they learned how to market because they did this early on in this system that they devised, because in the places, the new cities in the western side of the United States where they were first, back in those years, I'm talking about late 80s, early 90s, they were encountering static markets of users, same people, not a very large market, a lot of people tapped out, living in motels. So they needed to, and they couldn't kill, these guys couldn't kill each other because they all knew each other from the same town. You can't do that. It just creates problems back home. So they never, sometimes they were even related to each other, cousins or what have you. And so they had to become master marketers to take each other's customers. They had to provide, you know, little come-ons and discounts, and you buy for me Monday through Saturday, give you a free one on Sunday. Bring me five new clients, I'll give you 50 free balloons of heroin. They became great marketers, great branders. And that was, and also this system, I think one of the key attributes of this system was it allowed anybody to do whatever he wanted. You didn't join, cartels are very much like GM, except for they kill you, right? And so it's not like you want to be part of something. It's a top-down thing where rising is very hard, and you have to take a lot of crap from the people above you. Here, you could be your own boss and be a driver if you wanted to, or actually run a crew. Whatever you wanted to do, you could realize it through the system selling heroin.
It's quite the Wharton case study. I don't know if they've done one yet.
Absolutely. I felt that the whole time I was doing it.
That's the heroin side and the Mexico side. Part of the problem was that the market in the United States was ready for illicit painkillers because the ground had been laid by whether physicians prescribing legal painkillers, insurance companies encouraging them, pharma companies. So let's flip over and look at the opioid epidemic, at least the legal painkillers that were prescribed. What is the crossing point here, Sam? When did it become an epidemic of legal opioid prescriptions in your mind?
Well, I would say it was building certainly through the late 90s and into the early 2000s. I think probably a good demarcation point is when it when accidental overdose deaths surpass traffic fatalities. In the history of the American automobile, the automobile has always been king when it came to accidental deaths. And I considered it this major moment in the history of American public health when these folks in Ohio realized that that was no longer going to be the case. 2007, it happened in Ohio. I believe it was the next year that it happened nationwide, if not in every state, certainly nationwide. And I believe that was like one of these amazing moments in the history of U.S. public health, where these public health workers saw, oh my God, we're now going to have these deaths be the leading cause of accidental death. To me, I guess that's as good a mark demarcation point as any that you can point to. And what it means was what it meant was that the reason behind it was we had spent by then more than a decade doctors buying into this whole idea that they needed very aggressively to treat pain, and when they did so, there wasn't going to be the risk. They didn't feel the risk to their patients of addiction, so it didn't matter. The key point is that you believe it's non-addictive, but then you believe that, therefore, that you can prescribe as many as you want. And that's what creates the enormous new supply, coast to coast, and part of that supply, of course, is then the black market in the pills that's then created as well.
So that's really where the marrying of these two halves of the story come together. The heroin dealers coming up from Mexico and then also other places abroad looking at the United States market. And then the ground has been laid for various reasons with Americans who legally got painkillers. And then when those supplies run out, when they can't get their prescription refilled, there's the heroin, illegal heroin that they can then obtain and get hooked on to.
Absolutely. And these guys that I write about from Jalisco, Nayarit, are important, not because they're the only heroin traffickers from Mexico, because they are not. Rather, that they are important because of this capitalist system that they institute, very expansive, looking for new markets always. They cross the Mississippi River and land by pure coincidence in Columbus, Ohio, right about the time this promotion of heavy prescribing of pain pills is beginning, and it's beginning in the area with Columbus kind of to the north as this kind of ground zero. They are the first ones. The reason they're important to this story is because they are the first ones to recognize and then systematically exploit the coming market for heroin that massive amounts of pain pills represents. They realize early on that all they have to do is wait and follow the pills at that point. Because in the West, the pills really hadn't hit the way they had in this area. And they're coming in 1998, 2 years after OxyContin is released. They're coming and they're realizing, oh my God, this is new. This is very different. We all of a sudden have a growing market, whereas before in Salt Lake or in Boise or in Portland or in Denver or Phoenix, the market's static. Now all of a sudden there's more and more. And these are people with money. They're people frequently who are, well, they're not tapped out addicts who've been using for 20 years. They're just getting into this. There's lots more money here. They figure it out. They figure that out. 20 years ago, they knew what was coming. They could basically describe what is happening today, and they were ready for it with their system that they'd had implanted.
It's striking because they knew then what it's taken politicians many more years to really cotton on to.
Journalists, too. I was late to the game myself. I was like, wow, this has been going on for a decade now, these guys, at least a decade in that area, and I'm just now figuring it out.
There is not a day that goes by without me getting pitches from people who want me to write about the opiate epidemic, consumer groups, patient groups, whatever, and then politicians on Capitol Hill blasting out some announcement that they're doing a big initiative to combat this.
The first thing I heard about that, or the first inkling I had that was coming, was about a month after. This was May of 2015. Hillary Clinton's campaign advisor for healthcare called me. And we had a 90-minute phone call, I think it was, in which I suggested to her that this was the great unifying issue, that they would do very, very well to make this their issue, and it would probably allow Hillary Clinton to show the tender, warm side of her personality and be the mother in a sense, because that's what this is most characterized by. It's mostly mothers out there fighting for their kids. She was seeing it. This was well before the first primaries. She was seeing it in Iowa and New Hampshire, parents coming up to her and very, very vigorously saying, there's no options for my kids. It's the street or prison, you know. And they were struck by this, was what the aide told me. They'd never imagined it would be this ferocious. The ferocity was something they remembered. And I said, well, yes, you're going to find this all across the country now. It's just hidden. It doesn't poll well. People don't tell a pollster, yep, I got a kid in prison, you know, that kind of thing. They just don't mention it. It's hard for getting, but it's out there and it's everywhere. And if you make this your issue, it could be a very important part of your campaign. And she never did.
No. The other candidate, Donald Trump, was the one who really cottoned on to the idea of the opioid epidemic being a platform. Now, whether he's actually done anything on it is a different story that I think we should come back to in a moment. But it was in that 2015, 2014 range when things started to change. I just wrote a short piece about how media coverage and celebrity deaths, and I looked at the New York Times archive. 2014 was the year when they started to say epidemic, crisis around opioids. Really had been very quiet until then. This is a tricky question to ask any author, but how much do you think your book played a role?
Well, it's hard for me to say with any certainty, but I also, I know the difference. I felt it palpably. I could feel it, the difference before the book came out and after, and how people viewed the issue, how much they wanted to talk about it, whether it was a priority at major media outlets. All I know is within months of the book coming out, Sports Illustrated, Time Magazine, New York Times, all these different outlets began to really pay very close attention to the topic, and I also believed, and this is based on just simply going from place to place to place all across the country now and speaking about this, that it began to be just the book began to circulate very, very heavily in all kinds of places, nonprofits, state agencies, police departments, and I can tell you that just from what people have told me about hospitals and medical societies and associations.
I've been in senators' offices up on Capitol Hill and seen your book on their desk.
Yeah, so. It's a mind-blowing feeling because I'm telling you, that's not my natural habitat. It's more, I thought I'd be just happy interviewing gang members for the rest of my life and that kind of thing. And I never, as I said, I never wanted to write a word about healthcare. And now to see the effect, sometimes it gets very emotional. My wife and I get kind of teary-eyed at times, like, my God, look what this book's out. You know what it feels like, I have to tell you? It feels a little bit like the book is no longer mine. It feel like a kid who leaves home and goes off into the world. It feels almost like the book has taken on its own momentum and is flying on its own. And we just sit there and go, go ahead, dreamland. You know, go do what you're supposed to do, and not feel like. I mean, obviously, I wrote it, and my wife and daughter were integral in helping it be finished. But I do feel like all of a sudden it's become something that we never imagined.
My copy of your book is like a little dog-eared with some coffee stains
right.
on it. So it's in like
my
its
cop.
Well, yeah, it's collegiate stage of its life cycle,
exactly.
Staying up late. This is a reporter-to-reporter question, very selfish of me to ask, but
sure.
How do you top something like Dreamland?
I'm almost like wondering what it'll be like when all this kind of dies down. I mean, every day, emails from parents, emails asking me to come speak. Emails from, you know, I just spoke yesterday at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Somehow they wanted me to come talk to the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
Oh, now you're slumming with me. Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
you know,
the requests.
That was amazing. I was just blown away.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing to be there thinking, what the hell am I doing here, man? You know, nobody, not one person had a tear tattooed by their eye, you know what I mean?
Which was your old habitat.
I don't know. What I do want to do, though, is remain what I always was. Which was an immersive journalist, someone who finds a story or stories and digs in and doesn't deal with just the superficialities, but really finds the deeper story. If I can continue to be that for the rest of my life, whether or not the books sell, because I had two books that didn't really, I'm very, very proud of, but they didn't really sell anything like this. If I can continue to do that, then I'll die happy.
Those other books are the kids still living at home. Shifting over to the policy aspects
sure.
of this, we're in Washington, D.C. Your book is read by lawmakers. We have an audience at Politico of people on the Hill and influencing the Hill. What do you make of this administration? For all of the talk and some of the optics, there really hasn't been that much in the way of fighting the epidemic.
I was very surprised that the first thing they did was try to repeal Obamacare, because Obamacare has expanded Medicaid, and Medicaid has given a lot of people in those states that expanded it access to drug rehabilitation treatment. And I thought that this was the most important issue facing this this administration.
Opioids was the most important.
Absolutely. Not Obamacare, not the economy. This was. And this is why Donald Trump got elected, because in a lot of those swing states that he had to win to win the presidency, this issue, Ohio, Pennsylvania, some others, Wisconsin, and so on, this issue was the paramount issue in those areas that voted for him 60, 70, 80% sometimes. And I'm very surprised that there, so far there has been very little. There has been almost a denuding of the infrastructure that you might use to approach it. We're only now getting what we all assume is going to be a Director of Health and Human Services who might stick around for a while. The Office of National Drug, the ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, that has been cut to the bone. Or people have just left.
And they've lost a lot of staff. They still don't have an acting. They have an acting head. They don't have a political head. And Politico scooped for the second straight year. The White House is trying to gut the office.
Right, with a massive cut in budget. To me, that office under Michael Botticelli was doing some fantastic work. It was treating addiction in a holistic way. Law enforcement very, very important in all this, but also is treatment, so is prevention, and so is bringing in those parents. And I think Michael Botticelli did a really terrific job in recruiting, kind of making parents feel like they needed to be part of this. So I'm at this point as we speak today, I have to say I'm amazed and a little disappointed that there is not a whole lot more action, a whole lot more dollars devoted to, and also a long-term strategy. This is not something that's going to require 6 months and you're done, a year and you're done. This, to me, feels like, as I said in the testimony before the Senate the other day, this feels to me like something that is going to require almost like a Marshall Plan approach, that many years, a lot of the solutions come from local areas, not Washington, but facilitating all that, that's Washington's job, making it easier on those folks to work, because they're out there working. They are battling heroically. Brings a tear to your eye to see how people are fighting together, working together on this, and it's a beautiful, beautiful American thing to watch, but it needs that help from Washington. And so far, 1 year of Kara and the other thing that skips my mind, that's great, that's wonderful, okay. But there needs to be a long-term commitment to this. And I think it's also looking beyond this issue as simply drug addiction to the more economic issues and community, destruction of community issues underneath it.
I want to unpack a few of the things that you just said, starting with the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, which has been a battleground. You know this because you testified in a Senate hearing where Republicans argued, I think Ron Johnson was making the link between Medicaid coverage getting expanded and opioid addiction and opioid overdose deaths on the rise, kind of the correlation there. You don't seem to agree with that.
Well, I will say this. Medicaid absolutely has something to do with the expansion of this problem.
The loopholes, you get into this in your book, yeah.
The way it was used as a way of if you can find a doctor to prescribe a long list of pills for you, you can get the Medicaid insurance card, can give you access to those for a $3 copay. That happened in that ground zero area of Appalachia, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, et cetera. That happened all over, and it was very, very damaging to those areas. That's a big source of that. Today, I would say but you need a bunch of scandalous doctors on board for that scam to work.
You need the pill mills.
Absolutely. You need to be able to go by and get a long prescription, and that. There still are some of those, but I would say that that's really a rarity nowadays. I would say that the reason you are seeing overdoses increase in states with Medicaid expansion is because we still have a medical culture, even today, of over-prescribing of these pills, using these pills for as kind of a stand-in for all kinds of more thoughtful medicine. So the more access to healthcare you have in a state, the more access you have, people have to doctors who are going to prescribe this way, the more access to pills you have, and more people then get addicted and overdose. It's really a signal that we have not changed our medical culture significantly, even now, significantly, and that we still need, we have still a lot of work to do on doctors and what they have, feel that they have available to them, what kind of pain strategies they have available to them. A lot of them just feel the only thing I have available to me is a pill. And that's still the case. So
we had talked with the Surgeon General, the last Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, who did a lot of work on addiction. He was on this podcast right before that report came out. And I pushed him on blame. Who is to blame here? Because, again, patients say it's the physicians writing prescriptions. The doctors say we have all these pressures on us. Insurance companies won't reimburse for acupuncture. The insurance companies say we have pressure from pharma and from doctors and patients. Like the finger pointing goes all around. How much does it matter at this point, Sam? Who is to blame? And if so, who is?
I guess as a reporter, I'm more interested in telling the full complicated story and letting other people figure out who to blame on that. I'm not sure I feel like I that's my job or something. I don't know. Maybe it is. I think that too often, particularly on 24-hour cable news, it's really basically you set people up to blame somebody. And if you read the book, I stand by every part of it. What bothers me, I have to say, with regard to the whole Medicaid thing we were just talking about, is that people are cherry-picking. Oh, well, it's all Medicaid. No, well, what about all this other stuff that I've talked about? Come on, it's a complicated tale. Because it's a complicated tale, there is no bogeyman. That makes it maybe a more fascinating tale. It also makes it more difficult for us to get our minds around. Like there's a whole lot of people, in fact, behaving as you would expect them to behave. Pharma companies selling drugs. That's what they do. They don't sell wellness. We're deluding ourselves if we believe that. Insurance company is looking for any way they can not to reimburse. Well, I think that's probably what they do. We need to push them to do that. You know?
I think you're talking about the underlying profit motive and some of the other behavioral economic reasons for how we got into the situation in the first place. There is a group that has been vocal. I know because when I write about opioid issues, they ping me. And that's the patients who say they have real chronic untreated pain.
Right.
And the crackdown on opioids is harming them.
That's true. And I would say that there's probably a lot of people like that. And that's part of the challenge that we face is how to, first of all, in some sense, how to bring them down from some of these various stratospheric levels of drugs that they're on, because I don't think it's actually safe to be up on those things. And I think a lot of doctors would agree with that. But that needs to take place in a context of increased reimbursement for a variety of pain strategies. I would feel much more comfortable about a doctor sitting down with one of those patients and saying, you know, we fed you this bill of goods, we need to really work on getting you down, but at the same time, we're not gonna leave you hanging, we're not gonna cut you off. We're gonna find a replacement, and not just one replacement, but maybe several strategies that you can use that will be, you know, using to kind of, to treat your pain. That has not happened yet. There still isn't the access to, in most areas, the access to pain strategies that would help replace some of these. The other problem, though, is that, and this is an important one, across the country, doctors have for generations told people, for a long time, your pain is connected, your chronic pain is connected to a variety of things, psychological issues, physical issues, diet, you know, weight, exercise, smoking, et cetera, you need to work on those. And as a culture in America, we don't like to hear that. We definitely don't like to act on that. And so that's also, I think, part of it. It's a complicated story, but there's no doubt in my mind that in some areas doctors have simply said, I'm not prescribing any more of this. That doesn't seem to me a better solution than massive prescribing. It's like one extreme or the other.
I'd like to use the last few minutes of our talk to share reader questions. I said that you were coming in to chat on the podcast, and we got a bunch. So we'll start with this one from Jonathan Brodo. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing his name. While reading Dreamland, I couldn't help but notice how easily the Jalisco boys were able to come in and out of the country. Would the wall or tougher border security help to stop them from crossing? Or are they crossing legally and doing illegal things?
No, they're not crossing illegally. They're crossing illegally. They were crossing illegally. Of course, a lot of this story takes place when there was far less border security. So that's one reason why that happened. I have to believe, though, that a border wall will be very likely do nothing, put it this way, will do nothing to stem the flow of heroin and fentanyl into this country. That's, with regard to immigration, that's a whole other issue, and we could argue about it. But the thing is this, heroin is the easiest drug to smuggle and the most profitable drug to smuggle in small amounts. The only reason heroin exists is because it's great underworld drug. It has no real medical benefit that other drugs don't provide with far less risk of addiction. You can smuggle, but it's great for the underworld. It's easy to make, cheap, easy to condense, easy to cut, and it creates customers that have to buy your product every day, sometimes several times a day. It's also very, and because of all that, it's easy to traffic in 1 kilo, 2 kilos. So people traffic it in all shapes and sizes. A 50 kilo truckload, okay. A little boombox with 2 kilos, also. Most of our heroin today is coming through walls. That's really important for people to understand. There are not scads of people running across the desert with backpacks of heroin on their back. That happens a little bit with marijuana, but it does not happen with heroin. It comes through walls in the form on people's person, in cars, in trucks, whatever. Another wall, because in the Tijuana area, that would make 3 walls, because there's 2 already. I just don't see how it's going to help stem the tide with regard to heroin and fentanyl.
There was also a Senate report in the past few days about all of the fentanyl and other illegal drugs being shipped through the mail, and how little.
And the dark web, the dark web now is a whole other additive to this. We've opened a Pandora's box by believing in easy answers to complicated problems. The complicated problem is the mystery of human pain. The easy answer was pills for everybody, you know. And now, you know, it just exploded in our face.
And the complicated problem is also all those profit motives and right. Addicted people, and like the Maginot line of which can be just like the Maginot line was marched around.
Right.
There are different walls that can be got around too. Other questions. This one's from Frank Hood from the AIDS Institute, who says he's a big fan of your Senate help testimony. He asks, what should we be doing about the rising rates of infectious disease?
This is very interesting. When I started this book, I would have said I didn't understand the reason for syringe exchange. Why would government make a drug illegal and then provide the implements of its use? That didn't make a lick of sense to me early on. But you know what? Here's the problem. We have run out of easy answers. Now it's only, you know, tough questions and tough answers. I would say that the one way to control that is through syringe exchange. It showed itself to be that in the areas that have had it and have implemented those things. They clearly see dropping Hep C, dropping HIV rates. The problem is, of course, again, you know, kind of stigma and political will and thinking on this. And to me, that issue is directly affected by the presence or lack of syringe exchange.
Right. You're talking about the contamination that comes from sharing syringes.
Yes.
And the
right.
HIV and Hep C that come from that, too. Question from Barrett Thornhill. This one's more of a fun one, I think. I heard Tom Hanks optioned your book for an HBO miniseries. Is that true? And if so, what are the plans?
Yes, that's true. As far as I just as Washington, D.C. is not my natural habitat, so too Hollywood is like a foreign country. to me.
You have kind of a Hanksian cast to your features, though, now that I'm looking at you.
Yeah. Well, I think the idea is to fashion a miniseries based on the town of Portsmouth, Ohio, and the town of Jalisco, Nayarit.
And Portsmouth, Ohio, where the Dreamland title comes from, because there's that abandoned pool.
Swimming pool. Yeah. That was the center of town, and then it couldn't maintain it anymore. It was dug up, and basically the town lost its center and its community glue, in a sense, and was very vulnerable.
And that was the symbol for the book. Interestingly, after I got Barrett's question, I went immediately to IMDb, the movie website, to look for Dreamland. There are so many movies named Dreamland, including two this year. One coming with Margot Robbie, the actress from I, Tonya,
right.
And the description is, quote, a teenager's adventures as a bounty hunter take an unexpected twist. And then there's another Dreamland movie with Juliette Lewis, quote, on the night of the strangest wedding in cinema history, a grotesque gang boss hires a stone-cold killer to bring him the finger of a fading drug-addicted jazz legend. I'm guessing neither one of these is your miniseries.
I have no idea what those are. Now, this is something that a couple of scripts have already been written, and we'll see. That doesn't mean much in Hollywood these days. You have to have a whole season written, and then they take it from there. But so we'll see. I don't know.
Last question, and it'll be for me, my prerogative as a host.
Right.
I talked about this with the last drug czar, Michael Botticelli, when he was on this podcast, the nature of addiction and how so many of us are addicted to something. It might not be illegal drugs. It might be exercise. It might be... The president seems addicted to tweeting, despite every advisor telling him not to. I'm addicted to my job. Do you have any addictions that you would confess to?
Well, I was a cigarette smoker. I quit 9 times and never, and relapse being part of addiction recovery, never died, of course, but I believe I'm addicted to storytelling and exploration of new stories that just fascinate me, and figuring out all the elements to them, that not stopping with what the first level, but digging and then digging some more and then digging even some more after that. That to me is so far professionally the most exciting and fulfilling thing that I've ever found. And you know, they say that's how you achieve happiness. We've mistaken happiness for pleasure. You buy stuff and that makes you happy. No, it gives you pleasure temporarily. Happiness is pursuing something, working hard at it, loving it, and something that you love, and along the way it generates a fulfillment that we call happiness, a kind of a meaning and purpose in life. And through journalism and storytelling, I most definitely feel that, and I feel it frequently, at times almost a high, when I'm in the middle of that.
Well, thank you for indulging my addiction to talking to interesting people. And Sam Quinones, author of The Amazing Dreamland, pleasure to see you.
Great to be with you, Dan. Thanks very much.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Dave Shaw and Micaela Rodriguez for producing the podcast, and Sam Quinones for making time for a conversation. If you like Pulse Check, you can rate us, review us, share us with a friend. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. You can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.